Jersey.
The Right Hook. News Talk 106 to 108.
Well, my guest on the Thursday interview is Stephen Collins, not the boxer, but the doctor. Stephen Collins, welcome to the program. But in a way, a much more interesting story than simple pugilistics. Can I start right at the beginning, if you don't mind? Because although you're living in Ireland now, you're not Irish. Qualified as a doctor, where did the medicine come from? What prompted you to become a doctor?
It was when I was travelling, and it was in the early 80s, and I saw all the suffering and the terrible sort of poverty that people live in the developing world, and I realised I didn't want to be a doctor. I mean, I didn't want to be a traveller, just passing through, but a doctor was something you could help and change people, so it sort of came from experiences, really.
So you were a mature student then?
Not that mature, no. I don't know if I still am.
Well, how old were you when you...
I went to college. Oh, so I'd got a couple of years working on building sites and travelling.
But a lot of your classmates would have been pretty classical, sort of 18-year-old straight out of school.
And that makes a difference, certainly, yeah. Having that 2 years of experience, especially having worked, you know, as a labourer on building sites to get my cash, and then travelled in some of the poorest places in the world, you know, worked in places like Mother Teresa's home in Calcutta, and you've seen sort of the bottom end, as it were. It certainly helped.
So your reason for studying medicine, even at that early stage, going into pre-med at university, was when I qualify here, I'm going to be in Africa or somewhere. You didn't envisage having a plate on your door in suburban London somewhere.
No, exactly. It was always
even at that early stage.
Yeah, it was always. I've been lucky enough, I think, to find out what makes me happy and contented at an early age, and that is actually, you know, being part of the solution rather than the problem.
Now, talking about you had to work on a building site to get the cash to go to college, did that mean you weren't exactly reared with a silver spoon in your mouth? Or?
No, I came from a middle-class background. No, it was more I got the cash for travelling.
Okay.
No, I had in those days there was a good grant, and so I had the government paid for me to go through college.
I mean, just your parents. I mean, because we're going to talk in a minute about these sort of trips you took as a young man, and some of them were pretty hair-raising. I mean, were your parents sort of worried about you, that you weren't going to fulfill their dreams of being a nice, sensible sort of middle-aged man and all that sort of thing?
They were certainly worried about me, but not. No, they were great. They were always very supportive. They had always sort of brought me up to say, you know, to let me know that you should be able to do whatever you want. You know, if you want to do something, don't let people stop you. They were certainly worried about me. I disappeared for 6 months in Africa, got caught up in a war in Uganda, and then I sold my camera and bought a bicycle and set off across the Congo, or Zaire as it was then. And they were worried about me then, because I couldn't get word back to them.
But even now, at this distant remove, all these years later, I'm not surprised they were worried. So I'm sure everybody at this point is thinking, well, come on, get to the travels. Talk to me about some of those travels. I mean, this is a young man, 18 years of age, arrives in Africa, and off you go. Pretty hair-raising stuff.
Yeah, I suppose so. It never struck me as hair-raising. When you travel and you mix with underdeveloped poor communities, the people you meet are almost invariably good, honest people. You know, as long as you're proactive and you go out and you don't look like a victim, and you don't wait to be helped by someone who wants to help you, you just go out and mingle and mix with people. My experience has invariably been that the people you meet will be supportive and they'll help you on their way.
This had a dramatic effect on you. I can imagine that. But one of the things that really struck me as somebody who's afraid, other than swimming, I'm terrified of the water. I will only go in the water really to swim, not in the boat. You bought a couple of leaky old boats with what, your brother, was it?
Or yeah, my nephew Greg, yeah, who also lives in West Cork now, actually.
All right, what happened?
Oh, I was working as a doc in Jamaica and decided that it didn't feel right just to catch the plane home. And I found out that you could actually buy smuggling boats that had been seized by the government. You could buy them, you know, for a couple of grand. So we bought one, and Greg's great with his hands, so he helped me fix it up. And then we set off.
But you weren't exactly seamen, were you?
No, that would be one way of putting it. Yeah, but in a way, we sort of employed the ping pong ball survival technique, that if it gets hairy, shut the doors and float, hopefully. I wouldn't do it now. Now I know a bit more about sailing, I wouldn't do it. But we made it.
It did get hairy, though, didn't it?
Yeah, we had a Force 9 Plus right in the middle, about sort of 400 miles off Bermuda. And you were looking up at the waves. Yeah, now that was frightening. It actually, in a way, put things in perspective. I was thinking at the time, God, if I lose my life now, that's been a bit of a waste. You know, it's a bit self-centered. And later on in the wars and famines where I was developing these techniques to treat starvation, that actually always helped me put it in perspective that, you know, I thought, well, at least if I get something happens to me in a war, at least it's not just so self-indulgent. It's actually, you know, trying to make a difference and trying to find solutions.
Well, my guest on the Thursday interview is Dr. Stephen Collins, doctor, and I suppose I can use the phrase nutritionist, because if we talk about the malnutrition that bedevils Africa, I remember that, the thing that prompted, I remember, Bob Geldof, those famous BBC images of starving children and women unable to breastfeed and all that sort of thing. Presumably you've seen a lot of that firsthand. But you've done something about it. Now, what you've in effect done is a nutritional supplement, is that right? What is it?
Yeah, I think in contrast to most things you hear about Africa and the developing world, I've got a good news story. There, a technique that we've developed, along with Concern and backed by Irish Aid, has actually now transformed the lives of literally over a million children last year, treating starvation in people's homes. And this technique is expanding globally. And even more, I think there are new models to address starvation now that actually can mean that we are the era that can bring an end to this scourge that's you know, faced humanity since civilization began.
For me and for people listening who would have most recently, say, the Haitian earthquake or something, who see these enormous US Globemasters coming in, unloading bags of rice and all this sort of stuff, it seems, and I need your help here, it seems that you've sort of developed a technique where it's almost like boiling the bag, and because of the protein involvement and carbohydrate and so on, the balanced kind of nature of the product, you're helping that malnutrition. How does that happen?
Well, there's two different aspects. There's the delivery and the product. Traditionally, aid, and especially the charity model of aid, has been very much focused on supply side. You know, someone in Washington or London has a great idea. Oh, let's send them this. And it's sent down the line, and then it arrives at the village, and people are given it, whether they want it or not, whether they understand what it's for or not. So half of the technique is to actually engage with communities and get them to understand what malnutrition is and how they can go about treating it. And then the other half, the half that the Valid Nutrition, this new business charity, it's a social business that acts as a business but has a charity status. Valid Nutrition's work is to make these products in Africa using locally grown ingredients. And when you combine those two, you have a much more effective, sustainable model, because you're providing farmers with incomes and you're also incentivizing to grow appropriate crops. You're then adding value locally in country, you're supporting local manufacturing, and then you're delivering it to people through local networks in a way that they understand. So it's very different from the classic famine or catastrophe relief you saw in Haiti, for example.
That's exactly right. I mean, the whole idea of giving stuff to people has never worked. As long as Africa has been part of the British, German or Belgian empires, it's always been about giving them. Here it seems that there's a self-sustainability model. Now,
exactly,
how long away are we from that, you know, changing the face of sub-Saharan Africa, for instance?
This generation, that will happen. That this model is growing exponentially. The technique we developed, we only first piloted it in 2000. We got data, we had treated 23,000 cases by 2003 with good data. We took that to the UN by 2005, and UNICEF and the World Food Programme and the World Health Organization adopted the technique. By last year, over a million children were treated in 1 year alone, and it's increasing 30% year on year. So I was in India a couple of weeks ago, and one state, Madhya Pradesh, which has over a million starving children, is going to adopt the model. So in terms of treating actual starvation, that solution is rolling out. The more interesting bit is the actual business model. to prevent malnutrition.
But you've used two words which seem incongruous when put together, business and charity. Now, how does business happily be a bedfellow of charity?
Well, I think you've got to look at charity. Charity is great to fill in the gaps. But people in Ireland didn't become rich or didn't stop starving because of charity. They stopped starving because of economic change. And that's exactly the same in Africa. Charity is all very well, but actually people have a right to food. And if someone has a right to food, therefore, on the other hand, there is an obligation, a duty, to fulfill that right. And that takes much more than the odd handout. That takes a reorientation of business so that actually engages with the plight of malnourished people. We go in Ireland and you buy a burger for a couple of euro. That's cheap food. It's cheap because the economies of scale and the efficiencies and effectiveness that business can provide has allowed people to get that cheap food at a good quality. That doesn't happen with poor people in Africa. And so if you can demonstrate, and this is what we're in the process of doing, business models wherein you can make a shareholder return, albeit a small ethical one, by providing food that's actually good for people. And the key thing here is that if you provide a child between the ages of 6 months and 24 months the right nutrients, their brain develops and doesn't relapse after that, and they will never fall back into chronic malnutrition. And studies have shown those people earn a huge amount more, up to 40% more as adults. And so actually, if you get business to engage providing quality food to poor people, down the line, you have more people who are economically active to buy their other products. So it's not a zero-sum game.
But the issue of the food as such, though, it's still, and forgive my ignorance, but in a sense, this product that you've developed is, in effect, a boil in the bag, isn't it?
It's a ready-to-eat.
Yeah, it's a ready-to-eat. But the product is going to be made by indigenous peoples in Africa or India or wherever. So the farmer has an outlet now for his product. Now, the design of that, did you invent this?
Actually, the history of ready-to-eat nutritional foods goes back to Washington Carver, who was a freed slave in the Americas, who invented peanut butter. That's a ready-to-eat nutritional product. Now, what these products do, they add in essential minerals and vitamins, and they get the balance of protein and carbohydrate and fat correct, so that these foods provide the whole range of nutrients that a child needs. But it's not rocket science. These foods, we're just finishing proper randomized controlled trials to develop new recipes made out of, for example, maize, soya, sorghum. All of these crops can be grown locally by local farmers, and it's easy and cheap to process them to make a very effective nutritional product.
Now, this has been your lifetime's work since that 18, 19-year-old first went to Africa. Today, as a doctor and also a PhD in malnutrition, this is your economic life now as well. I mean, this company is yours. And in that sense, how does a company, because you must have charitable status, I guess, so looking at just the accountancy of it, if you like, how does a business get charitable status as such?
There's two organisations. I actually don't get paid by Valid Nutrition, which is the Irish charity. We started another organisation back in the 90s, which is a Valid International, and that is where I design programs and I develop solutions for them. So that's where I earn my money. With Valid Nutrition, it's a social business. So we went to the revenue and we demonstrated, we said that this is what we intend to do and this is how it will alleviate poverty. And the revenue looked at it and they saw that actually all the activities were directed at alleviating poverty. There were no shareholders, there was no distribution of dividends, so all the profits generated had to be reinvested. And so they realised it was a charitable enterprise, so they gave us a special dispensation.
But one of the problems of Africa, and you're more experienced of Africa than I am, but nevertheless, the greatest single problem with Africa, surely, is the corruption that is endemic in so many of the states, and particularly if we take an example of Mugabe, Zimbabwe, for so long, the breadbasket of Africa. Now, how does something like your organization work in countries like Zimbabwe, where there is endemic corruption?
Well, this is the change I referred to earlier, the change from the supply-side model, where you push food down a pipeline, to a demand-side model, where people understand what they're entitled to, and then you can liaise with them directly. So once people understand that, you know, the clinic should be providing this treatment, they can hold their local clinic staff more accountable. And for sure, you can never totally eliminate corruption in public distributions. But once people are aware of what their rights are and what they're eligible to get, then they can hold their local staff in the clinics accountable. But also, we're moving to a more retail model. 6% of the world's poor now are peri-urban, and these people buy food on the open market. The problem is they buy nutritionally poor food. They buy fried flour. Now, if you can show them that for the same money that they can buy some fried chapatis, they can actually buy a nutrient supplement that allows their children to develop their brains, then they will vote with their feet and
sure.
their wallets.
But this is a product primarily aimed at children, or does it go right through age groups or not?
We're researching a range of products. The key products at the moment are aimed from 6 months to 5 years, and those are for the treatment, one product for the treatment of starvation, one for the prevention. But we've done tests with other products that are aimed at adults. We've had incredible success of addressing malnutrition associated with HIV, because when you get HIV, people are socially marginalized and they don't actually get food. So on top of their HIV disease, they actually have malnutrition, which is totally treatable.
Are the NGOs drivers in your supply then? Goal, Concern, these kind of organizations?
Exactly, yeah. We would supply Concern. We've had a long partnership with Concern to help develop the technique, and they would be one of our major customers, along with UNICEF, Médecins Sans Frontières, people like that. So they would buy the product off them. And they would do that because we can save them a lot of money. Previously, these products were only made in Europe, and all the shipping costs, the high labor costs, meant they were high priced. Now, with Valid Nutrition's local products, they can buy them in country at a reduced price, and also all the benefits of their purchase goes back to the local economy.
But this is the first time, I would have thought, in centuries. So we are looking at ending malnutrition in Africa, India, and the underdeveloped nations of the world. I mean, this has never happened before. I mean,
yeah,
this
no,
is groundbreaking.
Exactly. Oh, yeah, that's why I say it's a positive story. In these days of gloom and recession, this is a positive story. This is happening. And large companies are starting to realize there are markets there. And once you have the economic power of big companies engaging with poor people, then you will see radical change. And I mean, Valid Nutrition, we're very happy to be leading the way, but it won't be us that finishes this, because we're a small organisation. So it's great for an Irish charity to lead the way, but ultimately, getting big business to engage in the plight of poor people with effective, affordable products is the way that malnutrition will be sorted.
And all this, you're living in West Cork now. Is West Cork a haven for peace when you come back from Africa, is it?
Oh, certainly. No, it's a lovely place. It's the vibe down there, it's an ideal place to live.
Well, as somebody who's studied Africa all my adult life, I never thought I would be speaking to somebody who would have a real possible answer to the scourge of malnutrition. It's been great having you on the program. Dr. Stephen Collins of Valid Nutrition.
Valid Nutrition.
And how can people help if they want to?
Well, one of the problems with a social business is that capitalizing the business is tricky. Usually, if we were a normal for-profit business, we could sell shares, and because we're a world leader in this, we could easily capitalize. But because there's no dividends, no equity, people won't buy shares. So we have a problem with working capital. So people can donate to us, and it would be a donation that we would keep for 3 years to have working capital to buy ingredients, and then we would pay that back.
Valid Nutrition.com, I guess, yeah?
Valid Nutrition, www.validnutrition.org.
.org. Well, there you have it. My guest, Dr. Stephen Collins, my guest on the Thursday interview. Well, in the O'Callaghan Hotels competition, Bernie Harold correctly answered Liverpool and wins a night in an O'Callaghan hotel of her choice together with breakfast, of course. She goes into tomorrow's draw for the tickets to see Ireland play Argentina at the Aviva Stadium and two nights in an O'Callaghan hotel. On sound, Michael Quilligan and Killian Keating. The team, of course, were Sandra Honan, Naomi Lennon and Anne-Marie Kane. I'll be back tomorrow at 4:30. Climate change skeptic Michael Graham will be with me, plus all the latest sporting previews in the Right Hook, 4:30 to 7. It's good night and goodbye from me and producer Mark Simpson.